Samuel Risley and the U.S. cutter Mackinaw are assisting the cargo ship Manitoulin, which is safely holding 17 crew members and ample provisions, but stuck in the ice. Both Coast Guards stress their commitment to safety and collaboration. Dave Packer, ABC News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Pete Hegseth, confirmation hearing.
I've never disparaged women serving in the military.
Except for, you know, the podcast interview in like late November of 2024 when he said women in combat weaken the military. Except for that, Pete, did you get body snatched? Are you not the same guy that sat down in the Brosphere podcast?
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Where are you at with dome stadiums?
Oh, love them. Snow games are awesome, but it's also a risk of injuries and everything.
Give me a dome anytime. I don't want to see elite athletes running on snow like it's me playing out there and tripping and slipping. I want to watch those guys run. I want the receivers to run and catch their passes. I want to see great athletes being great athletes.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Carmelo Anthony for the Bail Project.
Bad news, you've been arrested. Good news, you're innocent until proven guilty. If you can pay your bail, good news, you go home to wait your trial. If you can't, sorry, you go to jail to wait. But sure, you still presumed innocent. But since you can't afford bail, you've lost your freedom. That's not right. And that's why the Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting the in-cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us. It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Some Wisconsin farmers are now able to see how their conservation practices are helping the environment. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Farmers for Sustainable Food recently wrapped up the inaugural year of its Climate Smart program. Lauren Bry with the organization says after 1 year, the farmers enrolled across four states reduced nearly 50,000 tons of CO2 equivalents.
That's the kind of impact that we're seeing just on 53 farms. So we're really looking forward to years two and beyond when we'll have double, quadruple that number of farmers participating.
Through a partnership with Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative and a $50 million federal grant, participating farmers are compensated for their time and data sharing. They also receive support to understand the metrics and outcomes of the conservation practices they're using on their farms, like how the reductions from year one of the program are equivalent to powering more than 6,600 U.S. homes for 1 year.
What's cool about it is that farmers are already implementing best management practices on their cropland, on their farms when they're caring for their animals. And now through our project, we're able to help quantify what those best management practices mean for environmental outcomes.
Year one encompassed more than 100,000 acres of cropland and the care of more than 71,000 cattle. The five-year project will continue through 2028, but Bry says they are already looking for additional funding to extend it and reach more farmers in the upper Midwest. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny today, highs in the low 30s, slight chance of a light snow shower. It'll be a bit breezy from time to time out of the west. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 7, wind chills slightly below 0. Sunny and 29 for Sunday, but breezy again.
Right now, it's 22.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome comedian and founder of Chip's Money Tips, Chip Chinnery, and filmmaker Nathan Demming, who is touring Wisconsin to promote his film February. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and this is our weekend weekly assessment, review, evaluation, and description of those major events typically of the past week. And yes, it has been a week in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. As always, I am delighted. I am honored that you have chosen to spend some of your weekend time with me in discussion about these very important issues to the lives of all Americans, to the livelihood of our nation and beyond. As always, as a part of that discussion, you are invited. And that can be accomplished by calling in to Max, my producer, or me at 855-752-4842. That number once again is 855-752-4842. Max always reminds me that you can also be a part of our discussion, our review of these important issues by dropping a comment, a question, an inquiry, an observation into the Civic Media box online. Be a part of our discussion this weekend. And yes, indeed, it is a weekend broadcast that is full of significant things in the areas of rule of law and justice, and especially government, virtually all of it, almost all of it, prompted by the actions of our new president, Donald Trump, who again was sworn in just under a week ago under the Capitol Rotunda Dome. And in the wake of that swearing in, almost immediately began to enter a great variety of executive orders, undertaking other actions both directly from the White House and also from other agencies throughout Washington, D.C. Those kinds of actions are the things that animate our syllabus this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. Let me tell you a bit about our agenda for the coming 2 hours. Initially, we're going to begin where we ended in our last broadcast, that is talking about an issue that has become even more significant since our last broadcast of the previous weekend, and that is where the guardrails, where the safety bumpers, if you will, with respect to the kinds of things that a president, any president, including this president, can do under the Constitution, under the laws of our nation. Where are the restrictions, the controls, the limits? What kinds of things can a president do? What kinds of things can a president not do under the rules and regulations of our nation? And we began last weekend to talk about the roles specifically of federal judges, emphasized this past week as at least one federal judge told us exactly how significant the involvement of federal judges can and should be in responding to the actions of presidents. We also began to talk about the role of United States attorneys throughout our nation, over 90 of those in the over 90 federal districts in our nation, including territories. We're going to talk about the roles of the U.S. attorneys, not only in taking direction from an attorney general, but if it happens in violation of the fundamental mores and methods by which the Department of Justice has acted, taking direction from the White House itself on how prosecutions should proceed in the various 92 districts in our nation. And that includes, of course, the two districts right here in the state of Wisconsin. There's an eastern district of Wisconsin, roughly the eastern third of the state geographically, and a western district of Wisconsin. U.S. attorneys in both of those districts. United States Marshals also in both of those districts. Likewise, confirmed by the Senate upon nomination by a president. We're going to talk about the roles, the missions, the assignments of United States attorneys in the normal course and the challenges that may be faced by the incoming U.S. attorneys under this administration. And then, much parallel to that, the role of trial judges, federal judges, state court judges in assessing the legitimacy of things that a president and indeed governor, others, other entities inside state, local, and federal government, the actions that they undertake. What is the role of the federal judiciary, the state judiciary, in terms of reviewing those kinds of actions and responding to them? We know, again, that just this past week, a federal judge on the west coast of our nation has a very strong words, some very strong reaction to one of the executive orders issued by our president in connection with the 14th Amendment. We'll talk all about that. We're also going to talk about some very strong words coming out of some federal district judges on the other side of the country, that is in Washington, D.C., as they were presented by this present administration through the Department of Justice with requests to dismiss some of the pending, not yet resolved cases coming out of the January 6th insurrection. We'll talk about what three of the federal judges had to say about those petitions coming from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, coming from Maine Justice, asking once again that the judges dismiss those remaining cases that are still lingering out there. These are over and above, different from the pardons and computations also accomplished by the current president just this past week. And yes, indeed, we are necessarily going to be talking about those pardons. About 1,600 of them issued just this past week under the constitutional authority, as we have discussed in great detail in the past, of a president. Given that authority to do just that, to commute sentences as well, to reduce the sentences imposed against defendants, against people who are in prison or serving other components of their sentences. We'll talk about exactly what Donald Trump did, why those actions by him from the White House, arguably from the Department of Justice as well, are so incredibly important. And again, we're going to comment about the reactions of some federal judges to requests to dismiss the remaining cases as well. We'll talk about the significance of those. That is plainly at the top of many of the headlines to this day across America. And then necessarily, we're also going to talk about the 11th hour pardons issued by the former president. His name, of course, Joseph Biden. The things that he did in the last hours, candidly, the last minutes of his term in office. We'll talk about not only the prior pardons that he has issued throughout his term. Most recently, the flurry of them begun with the pardon of his own son, Hunter Biden, in late November of last year, continuing with large swaths of pardons as to various groups of people. We'll remind you of what those are and then talk about these so-called preemptive pardons for people who have not committed crimes in America. Nonetheless, the president and others concerned about the possibility of investigations and prosecutions of them, and so granting to them preemptive pardons. Here is a pardon that should protect you from those investigations, certainly those prosecutions, should they come by this administration. We'll talk about the merits and, yes, indeed, the demerits of doing that, as you have heard me talk before about preemptive pardons, the difficulties with those as a purely legal and procedural matter. And, yes, indeed, like all criticism against present and former presidents, an appropriate response to what we should do in the midst of threats to former officials inside the government, even people who are presently in government, outside of government, private people, all kinds of people who might be facing unsupported and unwarranted investigations by our newly arriving Department of Justice. I'll offer to you what the remedy should have been, should have been. Yes, indeed, it involves lawyers. It involves attorneys stepping up and representing people unjustly investigated in America. All of that coming up, of course, in this, our first hour. We're necessarily also going to be talking about the United States Department of Justice itself. Now under control of the new administration, the Trump administration, placing in the status of the present management of the Department of Justice, a fellow named Emile Beauvais, who just about 2 weeks ago was representing the now current president when he was appearing in a Manhattan courtroom to receive his sentence from Superior Court Judge Justice Juan Merchan for those 34 counts of violations of New York law. Emile Beauvais representing then private citizen Donald Trump in connection with that lawsuit, that prosecution against Donald Trump, finding that he was indeed guilty of violations of federal law, establishing a little more than 2 weeks ago that our current president was then and remains to this day a convicted felon. Emile Beauvais now taking his role inside the Department of Justice, no longer representing private citizen Donald Trump, no longer representing Donald Trump at all, but representing you. Representing the United States population, representing the United States Department of Justice as the acting deputy attorney general. We'll talk about some major things that he and others have ordered just this past week. Those involve directions, again, to United States attorneys. That's why our discussion about what U.S. attorneys do and do not do is so important. United States attorneys telling them what they should do when it comes to local and state officials who may balk at the president's immigration policies, refusing or at least expressing dismay, disagreement with those policies. What is the directive from the top leader right now of the Department of Justice to what those U.S. attorneys should do? And the answer is investigate and perhaps prosecute them criminally for not falling in line. We'll talk about that amazing, stunning directive coming out of the Department of Justice. And we'll also talk about another component of the Department of Justice called the Civil Rights Division. We have talked a lot about that in prior broadcasts. Significant things, again, coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice just this past week. The Civil Rights Division, effectively no new cases being initiated in the present circumstances, shutting down review of consent decrees that were in place, about to be approved by judges around the country, but also others involved in police reform in America. We'll talk about the restrictions on the Civil Rights Division, the movement of many longtime and newer attorneys inside the Civil Rights Division out of their present enforcement responsibilities and into a new unit that is going to focus on investigating and prosecuting people from so-called sanctuary cities who likewise do not follow the dictates, the mandates of the president's directives when it comes to immigration policy. Lots of things, lots of very troubling things coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice that are also not completely unprecedented in terms of directives, but certainly contrary to the movement generally of the Department of Justice in recent years under all administrations, Republican and Democrat. We're also going to be talking, of course, about the Supreme Court and the things it did just this past week. All of that coming up on this edition of Amicus, a Law Review. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at maxincradio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
Here's to a Wisconsin winter you will always remember. To playing outdoors in a winter wonderland. Here's to cozying up around the fire and holding someone close. and to staying downtown, where the food scene makes your heart sing, and to celebrating moments frozen in time. Here's to those who Wisconsin. Plan your winter getaway at TravelWisconsin.com. Sponsored by Travel Wisconsin.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a Law Review, our weekly weekend review of all things government, justice-related, court-related, prosecution-related, rule of law-related. Thank you for joining me this weekend for a discussion of many dizzying things coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice, coming out of the White House, coming out of Washington, D.C., including our United States Supreme Court just this past week. We will also talk, of course, about some of the, at least a couple, of the oral arguments conducted by the Supreme Court just this past week, one of those having to do with excessive force and the mechanisms under which judges assess the propriety or impropriety of police in the marketplace. We'll also talk about some other cases pending in front of the Supreme Court, including one involving a money laundering statute, its revival, its effective resurrection of a money laundering statute that just happening this past week. Lots and lots of things to get to, including, as I promised initially, resumption of our discussion about guardrails and standards, those kinds of things that we should be able to rely upon in terms of institutional limitations and conditions, restrictions and checks on the kinds of things that branches of government do. We know well that under the Constitution, this design by James Madison and others, checks and balances across the board between the legislature and the executive branch and the judicial branch. And for the most part, those have worked throughout much, if not all, of our 238 years of existence. Some of that beginning to fray at the edges as we look more and more to things like the Supreme Court's decision of last July, effectively elevating the executive branch above the others in terms of its power and authority and its immunity from prosecution for crimes committed. All of those things implicated not only in the past, but now just this past week, as the current president, under his authority as the executive of our nation, executes the law, as we talked about before, arguably, depending upon your perspective, taking care under the constitutional language that the laws of our government, of our nation, be faithfully executed. All of those issues coming into play in the hours and days after Donald Trump's inauguration, including these many different executive orders, most of them, not all of them, but most of them focusing upon immigration, ways big and small, all kinds of things that the president is doing in that area and others as well. We'll also talk, of course, about the executive order having to do with birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. We'll talk about what a federal court judge did just this past week in connection with that attempt to change the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. But before we get to all of that, let's talk about civics. Let's talk about the mechanisms that are out there that ensure that actions of the government generally, including presidents of the United States of America, including executive agencies and authorities, behave in a way that's consistent with the laws and with our Constitution. I have mentioned before that there are over 90, there are actually 93 U.S. attorneys nationwide, also in our territories. There are 94 districts altogether in the United States of America. You can go onto the maps provided by the Department of Justice, provided by our courts, and see where all of those district courts are. They together formulate also circuit courts. Those are the places where you go after you're dissatisfied, for example, with a decision by a district court, the trial court judges. Ultimately, from the circuit court, where do you go? Well, you may go to the United States Supreme Court if the Supreme Court decides to hear your case. I'll mention in the second hour that as of this weekend, the Supreme Court in this 2024-2025 term has decided to hear 59 cases altogether up to this point. Probably more being added. In the midst of that process in the judicial system, what are the roles of judges? What are the roles of United States attorneys? Let's begin there. United States attorneys, of course, are appointed by presidents. And they, again, according to the Constitution, nominated by the president, subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. Yes, the advice and consent, the approval of a majority of the senators is necessary before a United States attorney in any of those 93 districts can take office. This process also applies, interestingly, somewhat anachronistically, to United States Marshals, who, again, the very first law enforcement agency way back in 1789 in our nation. Our founding fathers thought the United States attorneys, ultimately, the people responsible for putting the laws into effect in these districts, ultimately. But significantly, even before that, the government, the Congress saying U.S. Marshals should also be confirmed by the United States Senate. We saw just on Friday of this week that confirmation process when our incoming Secretary of Defense was confirmed by a narrow majority, a one-vote majority broken by, if you will, the president of the Senate. He is the vice president of the United States of America named J.D. Vance. That same process, that approval process by a majority of senators also applies to United States attorneys. Why? Why? Because those people, while they should be and have been, for the most part, with some notable exceptions, apolitical and nonpartisan, are responsible once again to the people of our nation. Their role is not to be beholden to the president. It's not to be beholden to some other authority, but beholden to the Constitution, to the rules and regulations. And how is that done? That is done by oversight. Absolutely, by an attorney general, by a deputy attorney general, by other people responsible for administering the laws, establishing policy inside the Department of Justice. And so I had the great honor to serve as the United States attorney, initially court appointed in an interim process between two administrations, ultimately presidentially appointed in the administration of Barack Obama. I had the great honor to serve in his administration. More significantly, my boss, Eric Holder, for most of my term as United States Attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, responsible for doing what? Responsible for enforcing the federal criminal and, yes, indeed, the civil laws in the eastern third, approximately, of the state of Wisconsin. The Western District also present here in our state, a separate U.S. attorney located, venued in Madison. I was venued, as I have been recently, all U.S. attorneys in Milwaukee. There is also a branch of the court and a branch of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Green Bay to provide what? Service and support and safety and security for all of the people of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Western District of Wisconsin, and yes, indeed, the 91 other districts around the nation, including the Northern District of Illinois, the Southern District of Florida, which we've talked about a lot, the District of Massachusetts, the District of Wyoming, districts in California. All of them have U.S. attorneys responsible for implementing in those particular areas the rules and regulations, the laws, the processes of our government. And so one of the things that we have talked about a lot on this broadcast and others of civic media, again, is the responsibility of those U.S. attorneys taking an oath upon Senate confirmation to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. And that's where one of the first guardrails comes in. And we will see in the coming weeks the roles, the actions, the purposes, and the focus of U.S. attorneys now being nominated, ultimately, presumably being confirmed by the United States Senate, the so-called Trump nominees. We'll talk about the Trump nominees. We'll talk about the nominees and the U.S. attorneys who are going to be inhabiting those positions in this time when lots of things are going to be coming out of the White House, their roles and their missions. All of that coming up on Amicus, a Law Review.
Eagle, 1490 AM.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer.
Hamas released four Israeli soldiers today, parading them in Gaza City before transferring them to the Red Cross. They're now back in Israel, reunited with their families. In return, Israel freed 200 Palestinian prisoners under a fragile ceasefire. After needing Vice President J.D. Vance to serve as a tie-breaking vote for his confirmation on Friday, new Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posting online, thanking President Trump for his confidence in him. ABC's Perry Russum.
Hegseth fending off allegations of sexual misconduct, financial mismanagement, and alcohol abuse. Allegations he denies. He admits to infidelity. He was accused of sexually assaulting a woman in 2017, an encounter he calls consensual. Sources tell ABC News he settled with the woman for $50,000, fearing the allegation would hurt his career.
And South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is on the verge of confirmation as Homeland Security Secretary, a Senate vote later this morning. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks head west. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks open a four-game road trip. Tonight, they're in L.A. against the Clippers. Following that, games in Utah, Portland, and San Antonio. Men's college basketball, Marquette with another win over Villanova. 87-74 last night in Milwaukee. The Golden Eagles have never lost to Villanova since Shaka Smart took over as Marquette's head coach. The Badgers host Nebraska tomorrow at noon at the Kohl Center. NFL conference championships. First, the Eagles and the Commanders at 2, followed by the Chiefs and the Bills. Quarterback Josh Allen hoping to lead the Bills back to a Super Bowl for the first time since Jim Kelly was the quarterback back in 1994.
You always remember the feeling of not pulling through. You know, that sticks with you for a while, and it really doesn't leave. But again, I think every year that you go through in this league, you learn more things about yourself, about your team, about the game of football. We look at that, and you know, we just love the opportunity that we have.
That's the Bills' Josh Allen. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Welcome to Staples.
I am so pumped. My business is going to kill it this year.
Awesome. How can I help?
First, a new computer.
With Staples home and office hot deals, you save big on tech.
And a new poster.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny today. Highs in the low 30s. Slight chance of a light snow shower. It'll be a bit breezy from time to time out of the west. For tonight, partly cloudy. Lows around 7. Wind chills slightly below 0. Sunny and 29 for Sunday, but breezy again.
It's 24 right now.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have updates on important state Supreme Court cases involving the outcome of a November 2024 North Carolina Supreme Court election and whether Pennsylvania can count mail ballots with missing dates. First to North Carolina, where after two recounts, a race for Supreme Court justice is separated by 734 votes, with 5.5 million ballots cast. Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs was declared the winner over Appeals Court Judge Jefferson Griffin, but Griffin refused to concede and appealed to invalidate as many as 60,000 voters. Griffin's challenge includes voters with felony convictions, despite North Carolina's returning citizen rights restoration. He and the North Carolina GOP also challenge voters with incomplete registration information, some of whom are even elected officials and have voted for years. Wednesday, the Carolina Journal reported that the North Carolina Supreme Court refused to hear the case in a 5-1 decision, sending it back to Wake County Superior Court to consider Judge Griffin's complaints. Back in October, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court refused to rule on whether on-time mail-in ballots missing a signing date could be counted. Of the two challenges filed, the ACLU's argument that rejecting the ballots is a violation of the state constitution's free and equal elections clause will be considered. No trial date has been set. We have more on both cases at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us next time. We'll review the weekend happenings in terms of news and offer you another look at what's worse, your opportunity to call in. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
We'll be right back.
This is Amicus Law Review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name, Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, as we talk about some civics on our weekend broadcast, providing some context for the responses of our judiciary and, yes, of U.S. attorneys going forward in a time of change, undeniably. Some of it quite dramatic in terms of the way in which we understand our constitutions, our constitution, and the laws of the United States of America. U.S. attorneys, again, these individuals nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, if at all, and responsible then during the term of the presidency for enforcing local laws. And by that, I mean the geographically local laws. The laws they're enforcing are federal laws, but they do that in the local environments in which they are venued. 93 of them throughout the United States of America, including our territories. And so one of the safeguards, one of the conditions upon unfettered action by a president, for example, even by others inside government, is the United States Attorney, the chief federal law enforcement officer for the particular district, responsible for every single day assessing and determining whether or not actions, proposed investigative actions, prosecutorial actions, reviewing decisions to present cases to grand juries, reviewing decisions to open files, which is a very important issue now, making decisions about how the office, the United States Attorney's Office, how other federal agencies who are indeed under his or her oversight as the chief federal law enforcement officer for the district, how are they going to cooperate? How are they going to behave consistent with the laws of our nation? A huge responsibility, and also responsibility once again to you, to ensure that all of that is done in a way that is consistent with the oath of office to support and uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. And so the question comes, when a president, through the Department of Justice, or even worse, directly, directs a United States attorney to open an investigation of an individual, for example, for whom there is not a scintilla of evidence, there is not a predicate for opening a file, and yes, indeed, you don't have a probable cause to open a file, but you've got to have some reason to believe that the target of your investigation, even the subject initially of your investigation, may have committed some crime. And absent that, it is inappropriate, it's unethical, it is illegal to open up a file on someone because you do not like them, because they are a political enemy or foe or rival. That is not only inconsistent with our Constitution, but it is contrary to the basic ways in which U.S. attorneys are obliged to work. And so we know in recent times that the president, now in his office in the White House, has threatened to lock up his political foes like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. He has talked about encouraging the Department of Justice and the FBI to go after his rivals, his picks for attorney general. We know her name is Pam Bondi. For FBI director, his name, Kash Patel, have echoed those remarks. Patel's even compiled an enemies list, which includes Christopher Wray, the now recently departed head of the FBI, and retired General Mark Milley. People like that, many others on these lists. What happens if the president calls a United States attorney and asks that United States attorney in a particular district to open an investigation of any of those people without a predicate belief that there has been some criminal conduct? And I should mention as an aside that has also been the practice and the policy for very good reasons to insulate U.S. attorneys from the White House itself. And so all communications, if there are any from a White House to a U.S. attorney, should necessarily be directed through where? Through the U.S. Department of Justice and through the Deputy Attorney General, who would determine what the inquiry is and what the nature of the request or the demand is before sending it on to a U.S. attorney. That's been the process. We will see if that continues. We know that this president already in this week has directed U.S. attorneys to dismiss some of the remaining January 6 cases. Presumably, those are going through the U.S. Department of Justice. But that issue of process is also important here. The larger issue, of course, is what does one do as a United States attorney required to uphold and defend the Constitution and not open investigations absent there being a reason to do so? What does one do in that circumstances where the boss, the ultimate boss, the president of the United States of America, who has signed off on your appointment as U.S. attorney And the attorney general also signing off on that certificate of appointment directs you to open an investigation. What does one do? That's the challenge coming in for U.S. attorneys. If indeed that happens, if indeed people like Pam Bondi and Kash Patel and even the current president make good or at least try to make good on their effort to investigate and arguably prosecute people who they do not support. And so one of the safeguards, one of the stopgaps on that is the United States attorney necessarily saying Department of Justice, people in the Department of Justice, the deputy attorney general, and certainly the president himself, one day herself, there is not a basis for doing that and saying no. That's important, frankly, inside any government office, local, federal, state offices. When you are directed to do something that you know is unconstitutional, the obligation of your oath is to decline to do so. And you've got one of three alternatives. Then you can say, I'm not going to do that. That's not consistent. When you say that, it's highly likely that because you are an at-will employee, U.S. attorneys are not civil servants. I was for about 24, 25 years a civil servant, not subject to firing. But U.S. attorneys are. They are appointees of the president, can be fired at will. And it's highly likely that a president who's dissatisfied with the actions or inactions of a United States attorney could simply say, I am terminating you for cause, not for cause. Those things can be done. Nothing wrong with that process, but it's one of the things that could happen to prevent that safeguard, that guardrail, if you will, from stopping an action by a president. A second thing, of course, that a U.S. attorney can do in addition to saying no, which probably leads to his or her firing, is to decline to do it. And to ensure that that office, the integrity of that office is maintained, it may well be that that U.S. attorney then needs to resign. We think very generally in history about times when U.S. attorneys, in particular an attorney general, remember Elliot Richardson way back in the early 1970s, 1972, 1973, when he was asked by President Richard Nixon directly to direct that the special prosecutor at that time in the Watergate matter be fired. And Elliot Richardson said no. He said, Mr. President, I'm not doing that. There's no basis to do it. And so Elliot Richardson was not terminated. He resigned, as did his deputy attorney general. Ultimately, the associate attorney general, Robert Bork, did what the president said he was requesting to be done. That's the process. But that is one of the safeguards, one of the guardrails along the way. Along the way, one of the things that U.S. attorneys necessarily do is to authorize investigations, including grand jury investigations. We've talked a lot about that other safeguard. These are 23 people called in. They're a branch. They're a unit of the court. And under that system, under our system, grand jurors called in from the public. They're you. They're other people in businesses across the ambit of activity in our nation. They're called in to decide whether there is probable cause to believe that indictments should issue. And I've said on this broadcast and others that my own great respect for and recollection of 30 years of grand jury practice is that grand jurors do not indict ham sandwiches, as is often bandied about, an inappropriate and very flip way of understanding what they do. In fact, they do listen to the evidence, and they are a secondary safeguard, a check against a U.S. attorney, against a Department of Justice, indeed against a president who wants to try to prosecute through an indictment an individual for whom there is no criminal charge legitimately presented. That's also a safeguard out there. Along the way, during the course of the pre-public investigation, there's also the role, of course, of federal judges. And we began to talk about that last weekend, too. What do federal judges do even before cases are indicted, if at all, by a federal grand jury? Federal judges are also responsible for, in many ways, approving of the pre-indictment investigative conduct and activities of U.S. attorneys and of FBI agents and DEA agents and Postal Service inspectors and all sorts of people out there who are seeking to investigate legitimate crimes. And so, for example, if a federal district court judge is asked to sign off on what we call sort of an eavesdropping warrant under Title III, those kinds of things called a wiretap, he or she will receive an application called an ex parte submission from prosecutors applying for that and establishing probable cause, probable cause to believe that there's a basis for that, frankly, incredible intrusion into the privacy and security, if you will, of communications. Judges, before investigations, do those kinds of things. And they ask U.S. attorneys and they ask the investigators, what is the basis for our going forward to doing this? And if that probable cause is not there, the federal judges of our nation are obliged by their oaths of office to say no. To say, you know what, I'm not going to give you, Mr. Santel, that application. I'm not going to approve that application. I'm not going to give you that warrant to search a home, to search a telephone, to do some other things that are part of your investigative work, pre-indictment, because there is no basis for doing that. And that certainly would include situations where there is not a clearly identified federal criminal statute that is identified, again, even before the case is indicted, if at all. Judges have huge responsibilities. The one that we sometimes hear about, of course, is the responsibility to review applications for searches of properties, sometimes businesses, sometimes homes. And on a fairly regular basis, when I presented those applications, judges would sometimes say, yes, it is all there. They would sometimes say, no, I don't think, Mr. Santel, you have established here that there is probable cause. Either develop more or the answer will be no. And so there are decisions there that are made pre-indictment during the course of that investigation that are also checks, yes, indeed, upon U.S. attorneys, upon investigators, upon the Department of Justice. And that is done, again, in the interests of America. Along the way, one of the things that U.S. attorneys have the benefit of in that process is that federal judges have generally have a well-founded confidence. The Justice Department, especially in the wake of Watergate and other things, have some sense of confidence that these applications, the requests, have been reviewed at great levels. Most district judges believe that prosecutors appearing before them are acting with integrity, that their offices are not being manipulated to undermine those who may have challenged the current administration or its leader. They have to look at those things, but there's a presumption of legitimacy and of regularity in all of that. A judge can assume that a warrant application has gone through layers of approval within the Justice Department, even reaching, in some instances, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division. That's an extremely high-ranking official inside the department. That judge could also be reasonably confident that very little, if anything, would be amiss by passing that process through those various approval levels, including senior department officials. The comments, again, by our current president and others about this notion that we may be going after political rivals would fall into the category of undermining those assumptions. And if indeed federal judges, if somehow these applications get beyond U.S. attorneys and go to federal judges now have responsibility, as they have always had, but especially now, to check to make sure that the reason for the investigation, for the prosecution is legitimate, that there is a there, that there is a federal statute or a series of statutes that have arguably, maybe, been broken and that justify warrant applications, the judges granting those orders to search homes, to search telephones, electronic devices, to establish Title III listening mechanisms, those kinds of things. All of that is also the appropriate role of federal judges. Many other ways in which judges, even before cases are indicted by a grand jury, if at all, are responsible for ensuring the legitimacy of what's going on. And even in the wake, if somehow beyond a U.S. attorney check, beyond an initial pre-indictment investigative check, somehow a grand jury issues indictments and goes ahead with a prosecution proposed by the Department of Justice, judges plainly in the post-indictment period also have an obligation to do what? To ensure that the process includes due process and equal protection, all those things we talk about inside the Constitution, they will entertain motions to dismiss, motions to challenge the search warrants that they themselves may have authorized. We'll talk more about the roles post-indictment of judges and talk about the importance of this process as we go forward under the brand new Trump administration and the safeguards that are inside the department, inside the judicial branch, here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Earl Ingram.
Is there an absolute right and wrong in things and in society?
Sure.
So somebody on the other side is clearly supporting something that is wrong, and I'm supposed to...
Well, it's a two-way street. I think if we all would become open to talk and dialogue, we could get somewhere. The space between you can only be bridged by trying to understand what it is the other person is thinking and why.
The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for the remaining minutes of this first hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Also going into our second hour as we continue not only this extended civics lesson here on our broadcast this weekend, but also begin to talk about the applications of these fundamental principles to the news of this past week, including, yes, indeed, the challenge to Donald Trump's birthright citizenship order, the pardons of both this president and the prior president, things going on inside the Department of Justice involving commitments or lack of commitments to investigate and prosecute state and local authorities, a direct implication of what we've been talking about in terms of guardrails and safety nets when it comes to the conduct of a president, of the Department of Justice, of U.S. attorneys, of grand juries, and also, of course, of trial judges, both before indictment and after indictment, after a case has been indicted. If it meets and surpasses all of those thresholds, those checks and balances, and again, even inside the great majority of U.S. attorneys' offices nationwide, there is review, there's analysis of proposed indictments to grand juries. Usually memorandums are written identifying the bases for going ahead, the statutes invoked, the reasons why the facts support the presentation of an indictment to a grand jury. Grand jury, once again, an entity not of the Department of Justice, not of the executive branch, but of the other branch there involved, and that's the judicial branch. And so that process is also a safeguard inside the U.S. Attorney's Office. If somehow all of these cases go forward after having gotten a supervisory review, U.S. attorney review, grand jury imprimatur, they go before a federal district court judge in the public domain. Judges there, again, have great authority to do all kinds of things to check, frankly, the other branch of government, the executive branch, as it goes ahead. And that includes entertaining, maybe granting, most often not granting, but on a regular basis, at least reviewing challenges to, for example, search warrants that were conducted in the pre-indictment stage. Was this legitimate? Was there probable cause? Was the grand jury process somehow tainted in some way? Was the process by which the search warrant was executed improper, justifying some remedial action by a district court judge? Is the indictment itself legitimate? Not only in terms of its terms, does it set forth allegations that are credible under the statute that's invoked? Are there reasons why it should be either reduced in size, dismissed entirely? Again, the great majority of those motions presented by legitimate and authorized and appropriate to our system defense attorneys. That is a part of our process to ensure a proper and complete defense of defendants. Along the way, one of the things that can be presented, for example, is a selective prosecution motion alleging that criminal charges were brought for reasons forbidden by the Constitution, not contemplated by all this process. Defendant has the obligation there to prove that he was singled out for prosecution when others who were similarly situated, for example, were not. And the prosecution was therefore based upon an impermissible reason. Could be race, could be religion, could be politics. a selective prosecution motion. We know well, for example, that Hunter Biden brought one of those. His motion to dismiss his gun case on selective prosecution grounds failed. It was not granted. It's a high standard. But those kinds of things can and should be undertaken by judges. They should entertain those motions as they pursue their own oversight of the cases, plainly to trial and to sentencing, and again, at the appellate level, as we've already talked even this weekend, at the appellate court level, the circuit court level, judges have obligations to review what has happened at the lower court levels. Huge amounts of checks and balances out there beyond the White House, beyond the Department of Justice, to ensure that the checks and balances of our system are in place and are properly regarded. All of that, a part of our system. And although it's not a check and balance that comes out of the investigative and prosecution stage and process that we're talking about principally, we saw an example of that, a federal district court judge just this past week in Seattle, looking not at a prosecution coming out of the Department of Justice, but looking rather at one of these many, many executive orders issued by the President of the United States of America. This one having to do, you know it well, it's the 14th Amendment. Basically, the president announcing by virtue of his pen one of several orders issued in, again, the opening days of his presidency, that the 14th Amendment, at least the first sentence of it, no longer means what it says and says what it means, declaring that children born in the United States to undocumented immigrants after February 19th would no longer be treated as citizens. The order also extends to babies born to mothers who are in the country legally but temporarily, such as tourists, university students, or temporary workers if the father is a non-citizen. Basically, this is the birthright citizenship attack. This is the attempt to change the Constitution. And indeed, immediately after the president executed that, a federal judge, another branch of government, entertained an action by a number of different attorneys general, many lawsuits across the country, which continue to this day, attacking that executive order. And his name is a federal district court judge in Washington State. His name is John Cohenour, C-O-U-G-H-E-N-O-U-R. He looked at this, and in 25 minutes, he said this is blatantly unconstitutional. He said, frankly, challenging the lawyers now in the Department of Justice who are seeking to enforce what the president had done, he said, I have difficulty understanding how a member of the bar would state unequivocally that this is a constitutional order. It just boggles my mind. That's the federal district court judge in the check and balance on what the president attempted to do. Yes, it's one, but one of the many orders that are out there now representing the Department of Justice, again, on the other side, inside the Trump Department of Justice. The lawyer for the federal government said the administration's order on birthright citizenship is absolutely constitutional. He argued that undocumented immigrants, get this, remain subject to foreign powers and therefore have no allegiance to the United States, nor the government, argued in the filing, would their American-born children. And that's the basis, using that jurisdictional language in the 14th Amendment, the president attempting to undermine the clear language of the 14th Amendment, a federal district court judge exercising his assigned responsibility, another branch of government, another guardrail, another standard to ensure that the other branch of government does not get out beyond its skis, does not do something that's unconstitutional. The judge entering what is called an injunctive order. It will last for 2 weeks. And then he will have a broader hearing on this. Again, the injunctive order seeking immediate stay on the execution of this particular executive order that would have had huge implications, not just for the understanding of our Constitution, but for legitimate people in the United States of America, including children. We'll talk more about those guardrails, those standards, those applications of our Constitution when it comes to pardon authorities under the Constitution in our second hour as Amicus, a law review, continues.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
Ooh, let's unplug from the politics and rock some local tunes on Max Inc. This week, we welcome Or Does It Explode and Chicago Blues Hall of Famer Paul Flipwitz. It's Max Inc. Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network.
No more mold. No more damage. No more slipping and hurting. Make your ordinary bathroom extraordinary for only $99 per month. New shower, new door, new tub, new wall, new anti-slip technology. BCI Bath and Shower is made in America for the highest quality. First 50 callers save $1,500 on a Neverclear glass treated door. BCI Bath and Shower. Interest-free financing options. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. In Israel, tearful reunions. Freed hostage Karina Ariv and relatives reuniting. She was one of the four women released by Hamas today as part of the ceasefire deal. In exchange, 200 Palestinian prisoners freed by Israel. Minutes ago, Pete Hegseth sworn in as defense secretary.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. Secretary.
This after his confirmation by the Senate last night by the tightest of margins, a 50-50 vote with a tiebreaker from Vice President J.D. Vance. Today, President Trump waking up in Las Vegas to rally later today.
President Trump is speaking to his supporters here about a campaign promise he made ending federal taxes on tips. And as you can imagine, this is a pretty popular policy with the many restaurant, casino and hotel workers here in Vegas.
That's ABC's Selena Wang traveling with the president. And this is ABC News. The Afghan